All right, thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to speak. I'll be talking about some work to appear, hopefully soon, with Cheryl Shoke, Miguel Palos, David Pollan, Slava Richkov, and Alessandro Vicky. After Slava told us that we all shouldn't be distracted by corners on plots and theories, extremal theories and so on, I'm going to try to distract everyone. So the title of this talk is a conjecture. And over the next half hour, I'm going to try to explain precisely what it means and give some evidence for it. So hopefully many of you in the audience have seen this plot already. So this is an example of a result to come out of the conformal bootstrap. This is a bound on the lowest dimension scalar operator in the OPE of a scalar with itself in a three-dimensional CFT. It's an upper bound. So the operator we're studying is, I'm going to call it sigma. Sigma is some scalar operator. And for historical reasons, the lowest dimension scalar in the sigma-sigma OPE is epsilon. And the blue curve here is an upper bound. So the dimension of epsilon could be anywhere in the shaded region, but not outside of it. And this plot comes from studying just the four-point function sigma, 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 sigma. And the only assumptions that go into it are the assumptions of conformal invariance and unitarity and crossing symmetry of this four-point function. And the striking thing is that these very general facts about CFTs, these CFT axioms, somehow know something about the 3D Ising model. There's this obvious kink on the plot, and all indications are that the 3D Ising model lives at the kink. So that's the starting point for this exploration. We're going to try to take seriously the idea that the 3D Ising model lies on the boundary of the space of allowed CFTs. And actually, for this talk, I'm going to work with a stronger conjecture, which is that the four-point function sigma, 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 sigma in the 3D Ising model lies in the boundary of the space of unitary crossing symmetric four-point functions. So the full set of consistency conditions of a CFT is bigger than the consistency conditions we get from a single four-point function. It includes yes, Sohar. That, right, so, well, yeah, I guess it depends what you mean by allowed. So you could take allowed to be all the constraints coming from correlation functions in flat space. You could imagine that there are more constraints coming from modular invariants on tori and that sort of thing. Sure, perhaps. So what I'm going to do is relax those constraints so that instead of a single point, we have a space to explore, and then we'll explore that. I'll define the second space, but not the first one. Slava's seen the slides, so okay. Right. So for this talk, I'll just look at the constraints coming from a single four-point function, and we'll be very optimistic assume that the Ising model actually lives in the boundary of this space. And I think before doing these bootstrap studies, that would have seemed like unrealistic optimism. But after making all these bounds, we have some evidence that it might actually be true. So we're going to take that as an assumption and run with it, see where it takes us. Okay, so I'll take that assumption and try to make it mathematically precise. And we'll write down an optimization problem that's supposed to compute the 3D Ising spectrum. And then I'll talk a little bit about how we go about solving this optimization problem and then show you some plots. Okay, so this is what I mean by the space of four-point functions. So I'm going to consider assignments of real numbers to pairs of dimensions and spins So to each dimension in spin, assign a real number p delta l, which you should think of as a square root of p coefficient if there's an operator with dimension delta in spin l and zero otherwise. We want the following conditions to hold. So we want p 0, 0 to be 1, which means that basically there's a unit operator and it has unit OPE coefficient. They should be positive. P is for positive. That's the constraint of unitarity. And then these real numbers, P delta L, should give a crossing symmetric four-point function when you use them in a conformal block expansion. So this is the space that we're going to explore. So a few facts about this space. So first of all, it's convex. If I have two different sets of OPE coefficients, P and P prime, I can take positive linear combinations of them, and they'll still define positive coefficients, which give a crossing symmetric four-point function in the conformal block expansion. This space is non-empty. So if there's a CFT that has a scalar with dimension delta sigma, then that CFT corresponds to a point in this space. And actually, let me go back a slide very briefly and just note that delta sigma is here a parameter, and it appears in this crossing constraint right there. So that's how C delta sigma depends on delta sigma. Yes? This is for a specific four-point function of scalars. So basically, I'm. Yeah, the space of possible scalar four-point functions. Where the scalar, where all the scalars are the same dimension, and that dimension is delta sigma, which is a parameter for us. So. Correct. Okay, so we have a convex space. It's non-empty if there's a CFT that happens to have a scalar of dimension delta sigma. But there are also easier to find solutions. You can take mean field theory, or sometimes known as generalized free fields, and the four-point function of scalars in this theory, when decomposed into conformal blocks, will give a list of P delta L's that satisfy all the constraints that I mentioned. So also, the dimension of this space is basically the number of P delta L's that we can turn on. So there's one of those for every dimension and spin, consistent with unitarity. Minus the constraints from crossing symmetry. So these are both infinity. Crossing symmetry is a statement in terms of functions of two variables, so it's an infinite number of linear equations. One can show that the resulting space that you get by taking this infinite dimensional space and imposing an infinite number of constraints is still infinite dimensional. So we have some infinite dimensional convex space. It contains some points. So here's a picture. You can think of convexity as just coming from the fact that unitarity is a bunch of positivity conditions, so it gives you some cone in the space of OPE coefficients, and then crossing symmetry is an affine constraint that cuts through this cone, giving you a convex space. And there are various points. There's mean field theory, there are other possible CFTs, and our assumption is that the Ising model is on the boundary of this space. Okay, so if we have a convex space and we're interested in points on the boundary, one very natural thing to do is to maximize some linear function. So certainly if the Ising model is on the boundary, it maximizes something. And from previous studies of the bootstrap, we have some good ideas of what that should be. So, for example, from the plot that I began the talk with, we suspect that the Ising model maximizes delta epsilon over all possible choices of OP coefficients. Another possibility that is nicer for reasons I'll get to in a moment is that the 3D icing model maximizes the coefficient of the stress tensor in the conformal block expansion. And we'll actually see shortly that these are probably equivalent conditions. Yes? Correct. So this coefficient would be zero for mean field theory. I don't have to. I mean, if we try to maximize PT, then the maximum will have a non-zero PT and will therefore correspond to a local CFT. One of the things that you find, if you consider the first condition, try to maximize delta epsilon, then you naturally get spectra out that have a stress tensor in them also. So either one of these will lead you to a theory with that's local. Okay, so this idea of maximizing PT is what leads to the title of this talk. PT is fixed by a Ward identity in terms of the so-called central charge of the theory, by which I mean the coefficient of the two-point function of the stress tensor. We have bounds on this coefficient for general conformal theories in 3D, and these bounds are also very suggestive that the icing model is extremal in that it minimizes the value of C over all possible 3D CFTs. So this is another good condition. You can take either of these conditions and try to compute the spectrum of the theory that satisfies them, the theory with maximal delta epsilon or the theory with maximal PT. We find that the answers you get are pretty much the same. So this is, to produce this plot, we've computed the spectrum using delta epsilon maximization and using PT maximization. And this is the difference in the dimension of epsilon between those two answers. And you can see that it's quite small and dips sharply towards zero around where we think the icing model lives. What we expect is that, so this computation was done at finite precision, and I'll say what I mean by that in a little bit. But we expect that as we take the, as we do a better and better computation, raise the precision more and more, this should dip up actually to zero. And the picture you should have in mind is just that the icing model lives at some corner, and there are multiple functions that you can try to optimize in order to get to that corner, and any of them will do. Okay, so the precise statement that we'd like to make is that delta sigma and the OPE coefficients in the sigma, 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 sigma four-point function in the 3D icing model are given by maximizing PT over this convex space. This is conceptually nice because it makes reference to the stress tensor, which any theory has. So this is a very universal type of theory that you might like to look for. It's basically saying that, as Zohar pointed out, mean field theory has C equals infinity, so we're looking for the theory that's as far as possible from mean field theory. You could think of the theory with smallest C as being somehow the simplest 3D CFT. Although I should note C is not monotonic necessarily in general, but in any sense in which it's some measure of the degrees of freedom of the theory, the icing model is simple. This optimization problem is also nice for computations because it's it's familiar to computer scientists. Pt is a linear function on this space, C delta sigma. So at least for each value of sigma, we have to maximize a linear function over a convex space, and this is called a linear programming problem. And we'll solve it using the simplex method, which has been around since 1947. Okay, so are there any questions before I proceed to talking a little more about how the solution works? Yes?
So I know that in two dimensions, the lowest, the theory with the lowest temporal current is the 2D, I think.
Yes.
In 4D, is the free boson also included in the lowest temporal current?
So you can make this plot in different space-time dimensions varying between 2 and 4. What we find is that it looks pretty much the same in two dimensions. It starts at some value at the free theory and dips down to the 2D Ising model and then starts going up. And as you move from 2 to 4 dimensions, this segment shortens. And you basically end up where in 4 dimensions it starts at the free value and goes up. So the free theory, so precisely what you said is true. The free theory in 4 dimensions appears to be the simplest. Any other questions? All right, so we have a precise conjecture. How do we realize it on a computer? So the first step is to make the problem finite enough to put on a computer. And what we do is take these crossing constraints, constraints of crossing symmetry, and relax them from an infinite number of constraints to some finite number of n constraints. So we pick some special point in conformal cross-ratio space, and we take some number of derivatives around this point and only impose that crossing symmetry has to hold for those particular derivatives of the four-point function. So what we're doing is we're removing constraints. So for each number of derivatives, we have some larger convex space. As we take the number of derivatives to be more and more, we're imposing more constraints, and the convex space is shrinking. And eventually, we recover the space we're interested in the limit that the number of derivatives goes to infinity. And so for each n, each number of derivatives, we can solve our optimization problem and get some list of dimensions and spins and OPE coefficients. One can show that that list has n operators in it. So as we take n to infinity, two things happen. The list of operators gets bigger and bigger, and the dimensions of these operators start to converge. So in the limit that n goes to infinity, we should recover this spectrum we're looking for. And here's how the optimization works. So basically, what I've done here is I've unpacked the simplex algorithm for you in this particular case. Basically, in order to attack this problem, we had to implement our own simplex solver with some customizations to deal with arbitrary precision and the fact that dimensions can vary continuously. And this is part of why it's been 2 years since the last paper on this subject. But the basic idea is quite simple. We have a convex space. We're trying to optimize some function over the convex space. So what we do is we start at some point, and we always follow the direction of steepest ascent in the function we're trying to optimize. And since the space is convex, we'll eventually get to the optimum. So in practice, what that means is we start with some list of n OPE coefficients satisfying our n crossing constraints. And we consider turning on some new OPE coefficient away from zero. So as you turn on a different OPE coefficient, you have to adjust the other one slightly in order to preserve crossing symmetry. So in particular, you have to adjust PT, which is the thing that we're trying to maximize. So we try to find an OPE coefficient to turn on such that when you start turning that OPE coefficient positive, you have to adjust PT up in order to keep crossing symmetry satisfied. And in particular, you try to find which OP coefficient to turn on that increases PT by the most amount possible. So you compute the change in PT over the change in some OP coefficient as a function of the dimension delta and spin L, plot it, maximize it, and that's the OP coefficient you turn on. So then you start turning that on, and you increase it as much as possible while the other OP coefficients shift around until one of the other coefficients goes to zero. The result is that you've turned on one coefficient and turned off another, and in the process, you've increased PT by some amount. So you have your basis of N OP coefficients, and you swap an operator in and swap an operator out, increasing PT. So at each step, PT increases. You repeat over and over and over, and eventually you optimize PT. So that's the algorithm. And so here are some examples. Slava already flashed some plots of what the results look like. These are pretty much the same as what he was showing. So this is an example of the spin zero spectrum that we get with 231 derivatives of the crossing relation. So at this point, the low dimension operators have pretty much converged. And you can see here, so there's an operator with dimension about 1.4. That blue line corresponds to the plot that I started the talk with. And because of the scale of this plot, you can't really see it varying very much. There's an operator with dimension about 3.8, and then another operator with dimension about 7. And you can see, particularly in the plot of OPE coefficients, which is on the bottom here, that there's some interesting movement happening near the 3D icing point. In particular, we have these two scalar operators, which are somehow merging together into one value, which is good because in lattice simulations and other calculations, there's only one operator whose dimension is in that range in the 3D icing model. So they better merge like that. And the picture is even more dramatic in the spin 2 sector. Here, there are a bunch of operators that are rearranging near the icing point. And the effect of all this rearrangement is that there's a particular spin 2 operator that seems to be present to the right of the icing point. So it's got dimension about 4 or 5. It's this green line. And you can see that because of the rearrangement of these curves, the green line goes up and meets the red line. And basically, that green operator disappears from the spectrum, while the others just kind of reshuffle up. So this crazy rearrangement of the spectrum, all this motion happening on this very small scale, is not something that we put into the problem. This is something that's popping out of the PT maximization technique. And it's telling us that there's something interesting about the geometry of this space, precisely for the value of delta sigma near the 3D icing point. And this particular rearrangement is interesting to compare to two dimensions. So here's the spin 2 spectrum in 2D. And I want you to focus on this green line in the upper plot. So the upper plot are the dimensions, and the lower plot is the OP coefficients. So the green line in the upper plot on the right is some spin 2 operator with dimension around 3.5 that moves down to dimension 3 near the 2D icing model, which is at 0.125 on this plot, and then disappears. And in 2D, we know precisely why this happens. This operator is the spin 2 Virasoro descendant of epsilon. Epsilon has dimension 1, so there should be some spin 2 operator with dimension 3 if you act with the Virasoro generator. But epsilon satisfies a degeneracy condition, so that operator actually isn't present. It's a null state in the 2D icing model, so it disappears. And we exactly see this disappearance here in this plot. So the reshuffling of operators is something that had better have happened in 2D, and indeed something similar happens in 3D, and it would be very interesting to understand to what extent this is an analog of null states in three dimensions. Yes, Nadi. Right. Well, so what we're talking about here is, I mean, we've relaxed the constraints of what it means to have a CFT. So we're exploring some bigger space that includes CFTs, but also includes other junk. And when we're to the right of the actual value of delta sigma, we're looking at lists of dimensions and spins that don't correspond to any theory, but they do allow us to move around in some space and talk about approaching a theory. So I agree, it doesn't exist in the 2D icing model. And one nice thing about this procedure that didn't have to be true is it gives you a graphical way to see how it doesn't exist. Go ahead. Mention the solution. Right, okay, so I should, that's a good point. Do you want to mention it? So I should mention there's a very good understanding of this particular line in this case, which is that, so Leonardo and Balt and Leonardo's student Pedro computed a four-point function that interpolates between the minimal model solutions. It has a continuous parameter, which you can think of as the central charge, that that interpolates between 1/2 and 1. For each value of this parameter, they can write down a four-point function that's crossing symmetric and can be decomposed into positive linear combinations of SL2 conformal blocks. So we know that this four-point function is not, for values of the central charge, not at the minimal model values, we know that this four-point function isn't the four-point function in any 2D CFT because it's inconsistent with what we know from Virasoro symmetry. But it does satisfy these relaxed constraints that I'm talking about here. It satisfies crossing symmetry and that it's a positive linear combination of SL2 blocks. So this line here, the green line, is precisely following the dimension you get in that four-point function when you decompose it in conformal blocks. Is it? I guess the guess is that there are multiple Virasoro blocks that are degenerate, and some of them have negative contribution, some of them have positive contribution, and they add up to something positive. Good. So in two dimensions, we have Virasoro symmetry to guide us and tell us that there's something interesting that should happen at this point. In three dimensions, we don't, but the hope is that by exploring the boundary of this space and really understanding what geometry leads to this crazy reshuffling of operators, we could get some clue about why the 3D icing model solution is special. Let me just conclude with some preliminary results coming out of these studies. So we can see very clearly there's all this motion in the spectrum, but the window in which this happens shrinks as we take the number of constraints higher and higher. So we pick out a very precise prediction for delta sigma. In fact, our prediction is 2 to 3 times better than any of the best predictions coming from Monte Carlo, which, as Slava noted, is better by an order of magnitude or more than analytical predictions. So here are some examples of quantities that we can compute using these methods. And there are also some interesting observations. There are certain operators that are predicted by exact RG methods that we don't actually find in the spectrum. So there's some tension there, which would be interesting to resolve. Let me just say a few words about what to do in the future. So now that we have a precise idea of what we should be doing, one can try to improve the numerics and improve the precision and see what happens to these plots as we include more and more constraints. Also, having a more precise idea of what it means to lie in the boundary means that we can start trying to apply analytical techniques, perhaps to the optimization problem or perhaps to just the general idea of being extremal in the space of CFTs. And then another thing that I think is very important is to investigate what other CFT constraints do to this story. We started out with an assumption that is pretty optimistic, and it's amazing that it gives results that look even remotely plausible, namely that the constraints coming from a single four-point function should be enough to determine the 3D icing model. It's possible that that's too optimistic, and if that's the case, one should definitely consider other CFT constraints coming from systems of correlators. You can use other scalars, operators with spin. In principle, we understand, at least conceptually, how to put all these constraints together and set up some kind of optimization problem. And it would be very interesting to understand how to solve these problems and see whether the results look consistent with this. So, thanks very much.
Questions? I would like to come back to this issue of whether this is isolated point or not.
Yes.
I would like to understand, is it isolated point in the space of unitary conformal theories, or it is just a point in the full space of including that includes non-unitary theories?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I don't have an opinion about that. I mean, unitarity is key to this construction. If you get rid of unitarity, then we don't have anything to do. We don't have anything to, I mean, we have...
No, but then the issue is about what are the space of singular vectors, and this is probably what defines the model in some sense. So...
I'm not sure. I don't have a good answer.
Okay, thanks.
My question, so if you go to 4 minus epsilon dimension,
yes,
then we know that it's not isolated point at small epsilon. There's a Gaussian fixed point, and this is a Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So for small epsilon, so there we know that in that case it's not isolated point. There is a so if you do that, if you do same analysis in 4 minus epsilon, is there some new feature you find? In that case, you know that it's not isolated. Is there some differences with 3D if you approach?
I think we expect that for any finite epsilon, it's the Wilson-Fischer fixed point that maximizes PT and not the free fixed point.
Right, but are there any signs of some nearby fixed point or some?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, basically you can see that the dimension of sigma moves towards the free value as you dial the dimension towards 4.
But suppose you did not know that there is a free fixed point, but if you have predicted that there is some kind of reshuffling or, I don't know, something new.
Well, you get the free fixed point if you set delta sigma equal to the free value and you solve crossing symmetry, right. You immediately see the free fixed point. So all these spectra that we're computing will interpolate to the free fixed point if we dial delta sigma towards that, mm-hmm. and we'll take whatever interesting value they take on the Wilson-Fischer fixed point if we dial delta sigma mm-hmm. towards that.
But you don't see anything, like, you don't see two.
I mean, there's a lot of compression in what's happening with the spectrum because these two fixed points are getting close to each other. Mm-hmm. Operators move around more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually wanted to answer to Misha's question. So in 2D, we know that on one side, the easing model is approached by the non-unitary minimal models, which are dense on this line. So it's isolated in the space of unitary theories, but not isolated in this plot in the space of non-unitary theories. So it could be something like that happens also in 3D. But I mean, if you know some candidate theories which could leave, non-unitary theories which could leave to 3D Ising model, I would be very interested to hear.
Thank you. Your theory is particularly simple in that it only had one non-trivial fixed point. More general theories might have several fixed points. Would you conjecture that CT is a local minimum in other theories when there was more than one fixed point?
Since I'm talking about only the fixed points, by theory I mean CFT, so I can't really make sense of a theory that has more than one fixed point. They're different theories for me. The fixed points are different. So.
Well, if you add some symmetry into the theory, for instance, an O3 theory, there would be the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and the Heisenberg fixed point and so on with different amounts of symmetry.
Let's see. But the sense in which you're saying that these are the same theory is that you can get them from the same microscopic description, you can float either one. Is that what you mean?
Well, they have the same external scalars. I mean, if you took your theory below three dimensions, there would also be the tricritical fixed point and so on.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Maybe well,
we can talk later.
We can have talk later. Any other questions, comments?
So going back to two dimensions,
yes,
where you have these plots, or maybe it's a Leonardo's question, Leonardo's function. Is this the same, or isn't it the same as Feigenfuchs computations?
Pardon? As what computations?
In two dimensions, there is this Feigenfuchs construction, which has numbers that can be dialed. So I'm questioning whether these plots, or maybe Leonardo's version with the conformal blocks, whether they agree with the analytic computations you can do in Feigenfuchs construction.
They do. Yes. It's just analytic continuation through the minimal models, which you could do by an integral representation. We did it by solving a differential equation, but it's the same thing.
Does it agree one-to-one with Feigenfuchs?
Well, I haven't checked, but I'm sure it will. Yes, it has to, yes.
Other questions, comments? We're in danger of finishing early. OK, well, let's thank David again for talking.